This is Femi Kuti, and you are listening to NYC Radio Live.
All right, how you doing, folks? Feeling good? I am David Ellenbogen here. The show is NYC Radio Live. This was great. I got to hang out with Simone Shaheen, who is one of the great instrumentalists on any instrument, and in fact on two instruments. He is a mind-blowing violin player and oud player. His mastery, it's pretty limitless. He's involved in projects from jazz to classical Arabic music and collaborations with Indian classical, all kinds of stuff. So I thought this would be a great chance for me, just learn more about this music, and for you as well, of course. And he played a live performance for us, and he also shared some tracks. And the reason I was so lucky to be able to score this interview was he's got a performance coming up. And that is March 17th, Saturday, with his group Cantora, and also with his Cantora Berkeley Ensemble. Saturday, March 17th at Roulette. Should be very cool. That's 2018 if you're listening in a different year. Anyway, so besides this really great interview, but awesome live performance, he also shared some recent live performances from shows. So this is kind of NYC Radio Live exclusive just for you. And check it out. We'll hear a track, Samba Sika. And we'll hear another one. We'll just throw that in somewhere in the interview. And then live performance. And I hope you get excited about the music of Simone Shaheen and dig deeper. He is the man. All right. Thanks for listening. Peace. Thank you. You're listening to NYC Radio Live. David Ellenbogen here. I'm honored to be in the home of Simone Shaheen. Thanks for having me. Great to be
You're
with
welcome.
You.
You're welcome.
Yeah, it's very exciting for me. I've been aware of your music for many years. And my goal for this conversation is to understand more about Makam, more about really the some of the history behind the music you play, and then, you know, talk about where the new things that you're doing with Arabic music. So, and also about your life. So I guess my first question is, was there a kind of golden era of composition, you know, like a kind of classical period that people say this was when a lot of the music took shape?
It depends on what kind of music you're talking mm-hmm. about. Are you talking about vocal or instrumental?
Instrumental is what I was instrumental, asking about, yeah.
Instrumental developed very much in the 20th century.
Oh, okay.
In the, especially in different parts of the what we call Arab world. Mm-hmm. But I like to call the countries rather than saying Arab world.
Right.
Like, for example, if you take Syria or Cairo, I mean Egypt, as two fantastic centers. Lots of instrumental music was developed then, because prior to that, instrumental music served the vocalist, mm-hmm. meaning that if vocalist was to perform, let's say, vocal suite, of course, it included some instrumental music, but the purpose of this instrumental music was to serve the vocalist, to serve the vocal suite, and to establish the maqam or the modal system. And but then in the you know, the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, 1930, 40, this genre was developed. Many composers started to compose instrumental music. First, because they felt it is a genre that speaks for itself. It is as important as vocal music, especially in that region, North Africa, the Eastern Basin, the Middle East. But also, many players, they wanted to reintroduce the instruments, not only as an instrument that plays behind a vocalist and support the vocalist. In the contrary, they wanted to bring out the hidden treasures of an instrument, like the oud.
Right.
And you know, I was one of those in the 70s who brought the oud to the center stage as a solo instrument that could be played solo by one player, or a solo instrument that could be around, you know, chamber group, number of group, or even with the symphony orchestra. And so this is the story in a nutshell.
Right. And your father was an instrumentalist as well?
He was an oud player, a composer, and music educator.
Mm-hmm. So he was also at the forefront of bringing this out?
He not as much, uh-huh. but he used the oud as a composer, of course. This was his instrument, mm-hmm. like composers use the piano
right.
to compose, or the guitar. And the oud was the center instrument in the ensemble, the traditional ensemble that he had, especially in the 50s, 60s, 70s. And he composed lots of vocal pieces, especially within the realm of education. So he had more than 400 songs for schools.
Wow.
And of course, the oud was a major element in performing the, because he used the oud
right.
with the choir, for example, in a school or in a competition or in a performance. So he was the only instrument on the stage with maybe a percussionist.
Right. And I also want to go back. So with the vocal music, obviously, it sounds much older tradition. Where did most of the texts come from? Were they coming from pre-written poems, or they were written on their own as music?
Both.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Arabic poetry is one of the most phenomenal poetry,
mm-hmm.
especially when you call about the classical poetry.
Right.
That predated Islam, and then after Islam, throughout Andalusia, Spain, the 18th, 19th century in the Middle East, and also in the United States, where there was the school was developed here in South America and North America called the Emigre School. Like if you mention the name Gibran Khalil Gibran, who wrote The Prophet.
Right.
So this he was like one of the most elaborate and important elements in establishing this school. So the poetry, of course, developed. And, of course, there is the classical poetry that's called Qasida. And there is the colloquial poetry, which we hear today a lot. I mean, songs. So yeah, there were classical poetry that later composers, used it for to compose a vocal piece of music, mm-hmm. or a suite as a vocal suite, and also many singers had poets write poetry especially for their performances. Like the Egyptian singer Kulthum,
right.
who many poets wrote, poems, lyrics, and were composed by several composers. And she was surrounded by a good niche of poets and composers, and they worked together very well.
Right. Yeah, I've seen video of her, and it's very emotional to watch kind of. The power that she had. This poetry, the vocal music, you said that there was a period that they're taking from pre-Islamic period, and then there's, I guess, also you're saying there's kind of a golden era where of classical poetry. And was the music being composed at the same time as this golden era? Yeah.
Of course.
And
here an example.
Yeah.
One of the real golden eras of Arabic poetry was the Arab poetry in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
This is what we call the Andalusian time. And many poets who moved from the East to Spain wrote poetry, but in different configurations. I mean, meaning that they are surrounded by different realities than Arabia. Mm-hmm. Desert, limitations. And great usage of the imagination in Arabia, as opposed to a new reality where lots of greenery, mountains, gorges, rivers, water, and lots of it's different time where music, literature, sciences. Were brought to Spain, and many things were developed as a result there, but particularly music. Many Europeans came to Spain, to Cordova, to Sevilla, to study music, and the first two conservatories were established there. This is within the the context of Europe. So we are talking about a very, very interesting and elaborate, powerful time where music developed. And at that time, as a result of the surroundings, as I say, the Qasida, which is the classical Arabic poetry, was developed. First of all, the objects, subjects that poets used based on the surroundings, in new realities, in new life. Wine, drinking wine. It's not by accident they have like more than 40 names for the word wine. And so this was a fantastic time. And this genre of poetry that was developed in Andalusia was called Muwashah. And it's just the name of the genre. So many composers took advantage of this beautiful poetry that and they put music to it. And it's very much in practice in North Africa today. And many composers in the East, like in Syria, in Lebanon, in Egypt, in, you know, of course, North Africa, Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, they compose modern Muwashah based on the form and the poetry style then.
Wow, and that's 15th century, around there? 15th
no, we are talking here about early 8th all the way to the 14th, early 15th
oh, wow.
century. Yes.
Okay. Wow.
This was a long time then.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I guess.
And nothing develops, you know, in short increment of time. Mm-hmm. It, you know, time is a factor.
Wow. So I've been exposed to a lot of Indian classical music, and I kind of understand how the raga system is developed, is a modal system with certain rules that bring out a certain emotion. And I think there's some similarities with maqam, but then there's a lot of differences, and maybe you could explain, you know, because I've seen maqams that are, they'll say this maqam gives the feeling of the fall of Baghdad, or this, you know, and the way that it's, the scales are divided. So maybe you can, and I know you made this beautiful album with Vishwa Mohan Bhatt, so you've been exposed to raga quite a bit.
Yes.
So can you help me understand the differences between these systems?
You know, the concept of maqam has nothing to do with the, you know, historic event or imagery or no,
okay.
Not at all.
All right.
It has to do with you know, the emotional quality that is revealed,
right?
Both by the performer and the receiver, the listener. So, just to make it easy for the listener to understand maqam, maqam is a system, modal system, that on top of the Western division of sounds that we hear on the piano, for example,
sure.
on the guitar with the frets,
yep.
the sounds are limited, but they are divided, you know, into one whole step and half step. What's unique about maqam is that you have the microtonal sounds that everybody can hear. If I sing now, for example, for you, you know, a sound, a note, a pitch, of course you will repeat it after me because it's
right.
one sound.
Right.
But then it's very difficult to repeat when it's in context of surrounding pitches. Then you, if your ear is not used to to the microtonality, it will be very difficult to reproduce with your voice. And this is what I do, for instance, at Berklee College of Music. I teach there in the string department and the theory, and one of my classes is microtonal theory. And, you know, of course, we discuss theory, we discuss many you know, written you know, written accounts on the theory, but this is not the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal is to develop their ear within 3 months, which is the semester, to the extent where they are able to hear microtonality or quarter tones within a context of other intervals around it, and reproduce it with their voice. And when they listen to some microtones within a context, they can name the context itself. Meaning that if you listen to G sharp within the context of, let us say, A sharp major scale, then you will be able to hear this, the G sharp, if you choose to play it this way, you'll be able to recognize the scale and this pitch in the scale itself, which is great. And this is what I'm doing with the students at Berkeley, is to recognize the pitches and the relativity of intervals, you know, like the difference between two neighboring pitches.
Right.
So this is the model system in a nutshell. And the model system is contrary to the Western system. It's about motion of melodies that are so rich because of the microtonality. You know, it's like when you have a piano with two neighboring sounds, like, you know, the white key and the black key neighbors. Mm-hmm. You play them, that's great. Okay? But then imagine that you have red and green and blue keys between the white and the black.
Right.
And each one, if you press it, it produces the interim sound between black and white. So this is richness of melodic richness. And therefore, when melodically speaking, when you play microtonal music, it is abundance of melody that reflects great deal of emotions, like emotions of joy, emotion of sadness, emotions of achievements, you know what I mean? So that's what microtonality in the context of the modality or the scale system, if just for the better use of other words, this is what it can do.
Right.
It evokes emotions. Mm-hmm. Why in Western classical music, with two scales, major and minor, it's impossible to do this. Therefore, there's another system which we call harmony. And this within the harmony and its elaborate structure, this is where those emotions are revealed because of harmony.
Right. So, of course, with a lot more microtones, as you're saying, there's a greater palette of emotions that can be touched upon with makam.
Yeah.
Do you ever wonder, like, theorize why the West hasn't adopted some of these technologies or breakthroughs or advancements in music that were done in the Arab world? Like, is there a resistance simply for the sake of being resistant? You know what I'm saying? Like,
I understand what you're saying. I don't think they are resisting. No, not at all. No. There was a resistance. Towards the late 15th, 16th century, composers and theorists, they start to deal with this issue of tempered tuning sounds, meaning that, just again to simplify it, is to contain the melodic richness, to simplify it
right
to one step and half step. I don't know if this will make any sense, but by the simplification of the melody and then adding to it the harmonic structure,
right,
this is their philosophical direction. Mm-hmm. It's a philosophy, you know.
Right.
We cannot say it's great or bad.
Right.
It's you know, they wanted that, then it happened. But before that, even music in Europe, they had a great deal of microtonality.
Sure.
Even now,
Yeah.
And people don't know about that.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I talk about music, traditional folkloric music from Ireland, from Eastern Europe, from
the Balkans,
from France, southern France, troubadours, and Spain. What about Spain?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I show the microtonality in their music. I talk about music in America, you know, like root folk music.
Sure.
When it's played on violin or cello, mm-hmm. or, you know, it's infested with microtonality. Not many people know that, but it is.
Right.
So it is there. It is out there. And I would say, from my knowledge of music from different parts of the world, more than 70% of world culture, they practice microtonality.
Mm.
So it's not that it's a hidden treasure or whatever,
right.
or something that people try to destroy or
it's hidden in plain sight.
It is there, and people are aware of it,
right.
and composers are aware of it very much.
I would love to, you know, hear some examples of some of the stuff we've talked about here, how, you know, I don't know, you can kind of unlock some of the technology behind the macams. I've also heard people explain to me that sometimes there is an implied change in the tonic. Is that correct? Like, I'd be listening to some Arabic music and they would say, you see, like, there's sometimes almost like a harmonic motion implied, like that kind of, it'll always move somewhere over a cycle.
You know, the word harmony is very, you know, it is, we have to use it carefully.
Okay.
You know?
Well, maybe the root almost is implying a movement of the root or something like this.
You know, to simplify again, to simplify, the maqam system, again, it is about recognizing the microtonality, mm-hmm. and the way it is shaped, put within a context, okay? And some people want to simplify and they go as far as playing the mode or the maqam with quarter tone or microtones as a scale. You know, okay, that's fine, okay? But you don't get the idea or the benefits of the maqam by playing it as a scale. Mm-hmm. It has to be within the context of a performance, like improvisation or a composition. The same with Indian music. Mm-hmm. What's the value of playing raga like a scale?
Right.
It has no value. But when you experience a performance, then you understand the depth of the raga. Which incorporates not only the use of those delicate pitches, but also the use of ornamentation, the slides, the rhythms, you know, this inner right. rhythms within the rag or the maqam.
Mm-hmm.
And this is another component that is very, very much, very rich and very used in both Indian and Arabic the model system.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you, I mean, obviously you've kind of brought the virtuosity on oud and violin to a new place, and I also wanted to know how you think about rhythm. You know, is it something you even think about? You think attack rhythm very systematically? Is it dooms and texts, or you know, how in your own mind, how do you approach rhythm and increasing your facility with it and freedom?
Two things when it comes to rhythm. You know, people, whatever they do, they do it with rhythm, right?
Yeah.
Do you walk without rhythm? It's impossible, right?
Right.
Even when you eat, there is certain rhythm. Mm-hmm. So, two things. Rhythm, you have the actual rhythmic modes, you know, the mm-hmm. that the figures themselves that you need to learn, and they are applied to instrumental or vocal music. When I mentioned the Andalusian Mwashah mm-hmm. Vocal form, one of the most elaborate features of the Mwashah is the rhythmic modes, which could be very elaborate, very complex, and it coincides with the rhythm of the poetry itself, okay, and the rhyming of the poetry. So, of course, when you say 10 beats per measure, you cannot go and say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. It means nothing. But when you start to think about the downbeats and the offbeats, as you said, mm-hmm. which we call dom and tax, and then you create a subdivision within the 10, then people can start to swing with the rhythm, whether the performer who is improvising or playing a piece of music or the listener who is receiving the information, they start to swing. It's not by by accident, then people move their heads and they nod and they move their bodies when they listen to a performance with certain rhythmic mode. So this is one thing about rhythm. But the other part of rhythm is about the performance itself. It is about not counting and not know. It's how you swing with the rhythm itself. How you can make the rhythm feel it's longer, but the time is good, you know?
Pulling and pushing.
Yeah,
and
pulling
stretching.
And pushing, expanding. And this is beauty in rhythm. Of course, players, they have to be on certain artistic quality in order to be able to do that.
Yeah.
Many people, they try and listen to them. Trying is a beginning, but it takes time. It takes time and mastery and experience in order to pull the rhythm in any way you want, break it apart, push it up and down. It's beautiful, and this part of the great performance.
And could you always, like, I hear you do certain things, and it's at the edge of my understanding, or beyond, you know, just even just speed. I'm like, oh, was that six strokes in a beat, you know, or what was that, you know? Could you always hear these things, or was that something that you pushed your mind to be able to hear in terms of the perfect subdivisions at a very fast speed or something like that?
It's a combination of learning this, hearing it a lot, starting in childhood. Because any tradition, when you start at childhood, and provided you have the talent, without talent, you know, as a child you can do anything, but we reach nowhere. This is why people use the word mediocrity,
right.
Which I don't agree with. But talent plus exposure plus good masters around you that can lead or expose you to the great masterpieces of both the vocal and the instrumental. This is a must. But then comes the experience. The beauty is to play. It's like when you take a violinist playing a concerto by Beethoven, let's say, or Brahms. When they start to work on it, they have to work on fingering on left hand and the bowing and how you divide, you know, phrasing. And when they perform, they don't change the fingering nor the bowing. It is exactly as they learned it.
Right.
But great violinists, they surpass that. Of course, they use the same fingering, the same bowing that they learned as they were preparing the piece of music, the concerto. But when it comes, when the time comes for the performance, it's on the performance level, then they don't think anymore about fingering or bowing or how to phrase or dynamics. Constitute music and expression is that you pour your own feelings, your own understanding and conviction, musical conviction, into the piece. And there's also one more thing, it's your own sound. When you listen to some Indian musician playing sarod or sitar or the sliding guitar, you right away, if they are masters, you know who's that sound.
Right.
So this is the unique thing about, reaching certain mastery and where you don't have to count rhythms and you don't have to think about modulations.
Right.
It's your sound and your the moment of the performance, which is very magical.
Yeah. Well, the oud is right here, and I'd love to... Maybe you could play some stuff and give examples of some of the things we've talked about. And if you wouldn't mind, you probably need a second to tune.
So one of the strings went out of tune, but I didn't use it.
Ah, that's smart. That's a professional trick.
Yeah. Great.
So was that in a particular maqam, or you were just going for it?
Yeah, it was based on maqam called Bayati, where you have the second pitch of the scale. It's a microtonal. Mm-hmm. But then I did several modulations to other, let's use the word scale so that mm-hmm. people get used yeah. to it. Other family-related scales that belongs to this Bayati. It's Bayati right. when you say like major scale, minor scale, mm-hmm. Bayati scale. And this is where you have those contrast and colors that works together beautifully and brings out, evokes, you know, ideas, emotions, whatever.
Yeah, there was a particular note made kind of, you had a very kind of fast kind of motion on one of the notes that was extremely, a lot of emotion came out there. I'm not sure which degree of the scale that was. There's also, that's another big difference between a raga system and a makam system, is that there's a skill of switching, right? Like you're saying, of
modulating.
Modulating, yeah.
You know, in the very classical raga system, as you know, I assume you know it better than me, much better. But it's obvious that the modulations are very rhythmic. Mm-hmm. You need to maintain the same intervals and pitches of the raga.
Sure.
Otherwise, somebody is going to be angry at you.
Oh, yeah. Right? Someone's going to be angry anyway, but yeah.
Especially goddess. In Arabic music, like in Egypt, in Syria, in Lebanon, the Indian music, it moves eerily, it modulates rhythmically, beautifully. But you have to maintain the same pitches. Mm-hmm. There, I don't see any great deal of melodic modulations there. Sure. In Arabic music, the philosophy is the contrary. The beauty is about modulating from one maqam or mood to the other. And this is what creates the tension, the resolution, the contrast, the coloring. Mm. And this is a different philosophy of approaching music, of course. But again, there is great rhythmic, you know, like hidden rhythmic patterns that carries all these. For example, what I played now is an improvisation. There were several rhythmic patterns embedded in this motion. So the rhythm is there, of course. But basically, this is the difference that I can see. Of course, if we go to the depth of it, there are many commonalities and many other differences.
Yeah. Wow. So you talked a little before, in a certain way, you were born into this, because obviously you had natural talent. Your father was a great educator. You got exposed very young. But for the rest of us, what do you think you've done to achieve, you know, a level of facility and virtuosity when you sit down? What's the approach that you think has brought you to the place that you are, with the freedom and kind of almost, you know, perfection in terms of intonation, all these things? What is there something, you know?
Since childhood, I was always exposed to so many kinds of music, including Indian music.
Yeah.
And of course, without say the Arabic music as its best, traditionally speaking. But I was, you know, at the age of 5, I was playing the oud and the violin. And I learned the violin at the Western Conservatory of Music. So I played both Western classical style and the Arabic style on the violin. And there is a violin that's played Indian style.
Sure.
Okay. It's an instrument that lends itself to so many cultures, and the cultures do whatever suits them. And definitely the violin is an instrument that speaks to many people in the world. So I played both instruments. So there is, you know, this dualism in my life where I was born playing oud and violin, and dealing with, you know, working with Western classical music and Arabic traditional music, as well as others. But let's keep this this dualism. And compose, when, you know, in my teenage, I started to compose. again, different styles. There is also dualism there. Mm-hmm. And a performance, performing the very traditional classical style, at the same time performing something out of the box. And this is, I always felt that. This is when I went to teach at Berklee College of Music. We had a big meeting and celebration. And the first thing I said in my speech, I hope that this is a place where we can bring the walls down and let music seeps through into each other. It's my conviction. I believe that. But in order to be able to do this marriage of styles, genres, different cultures, you need to be aware and you need to... I talk about myself. I was aware and I know the music. I know Western classical music. I know jazz very well. I know Arabic music very well. I know Indian music to a certain extent. And many other styles, South American. So when you know all these musics and then you want to put a work that draws on various elements, it's possible if you understand the commonalities, if you understand the sound, if you understand the instruments, how they work together. It's possible, definitely.
And so what's your project? I know, well, one, you have a concert coming up very soon.
Correct.
But what's the thing that's keeping you excited about music? What's the thing that you're trying to achieve in your various groups? I know you have some fusion projects and various groups. So, you know, what are your goals? What's happening in the future for you?
You know, as far as performance, you know, I perform a lot, and performance is a performance. It's going up there, doing a performance with utmost respect, and preparing for a performance the right way, so that when a performance happens, there is a cohesiveness, there is an energy going on the stage. If it's me alone, I know what I'm going to do. But if I have a group of musicians around me, then we work on it. We prepare ourselves. And there are beautiful moments in a performance, each performance that happen, that they are not going to be revealed in a concert tomorrow or yesterday. It's like composing.
Right.
If I have an idea today, and if I don't really catch it on time and put it on a piece of paper so I remember it, it's not going to be repeated again tomorrow or 2 hours from now. You know that your mind is
sure
will empty.
I can attest to that. Yeah.
Will delete it, right? Yeah. So take advantage of the moment of of creativity, if you will. And there is a moment of performance, moment of composition, moment of teaching. It's all there is creativity in all of them. And this is what keeps the drive. Yeah. Otherwise, I mean, I don't see why I should perform.
Right. All right. Well, it's been really inspirational talking to you. Thank you for your time. The show is, do we know the date?
So we're doing the show here in Brooklyn at the Roulette Concert Hall on March 17.
Okay.
At 8 o'clock, this coming March. And it's going to be a performance that will include my own musicians that I have been working with for ages who are in New York. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I'm going to bring some phenomenal musicians from Berklee College of Music who are in my own ensemble. I have an ensemble in New York called Cantera.
Right.
But at Berklee, I call it Cantera Berklee Ensemble for differentiation. So I will bring few phenomenal musicians that are going to join us and do a performance, some of it my own composition, and some of it from music that was performed in the heights of Arab cinema.
Oh,
particularly,
wow.
You know, in Egypt, in Syria, and much of this music also instrumental. So we are going to perform such.
Oh, that's exciting! Genres. Very cool. All right. Well, keep it going. Thanks for your time. Thanks
You're
for
welcome.
All the music.
Thanks.
Take care.